Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Go Ahead's full year results for July 2nd, 2016. Just like to start off by thanking you all for being here. I'm sure you had your whole of your diaries around next week's announcements. We, for obvious reasons, have brought it forward. I'm very grateful for you being here. I'd also like to say to Investec, thank you very much as well for hosting us at such short notice and in the same room, which is very good of you. So I'm going to go through some highlights, and I'm going to pass over to Patrick Butcher for the financial results and the detail. I'll come back again and talk through some more color about some of the divisions, what's happened over the last year, and then we'll have a Q&A as normal. So starting with the highlights, overall results slightly ahead of our expectations. I'm really pleased to say we've met our 100 million pound bus profit target on our original timescale, and the bus adjusted profit is up 8% to 100.4 million. Regional bus adjusted operating profit up 9.4% to 53.3 million, and we've had passenger growth in the second half slightly ahead of the first half, but overall these are steady passenger numbers being organically grown in the regional bus. London bus adjusted operating profit up 6.3% to 47.1 million, and that's despite a significant reduction in Quick's income. Rail adjusted profit at 57 million with a margin of 2.3%. We've made a significant contribution to DfT during the year of over 222 million. We've had continued difficulties for GTR, which I'm sure there'll be questions on, but our expectations remain the same with regard to the profit over the life of the contract, as we explained at the pre-close. Our Singapore bus contract goes live this weekend. We're very excited about. Mobilisation costs are in line with our bid assumptions, and we also started the mobilisation of rail contracts in Germany. Our bid team has been established for the West Midlands franchise, and that bid submission is due at the end of the year. We've got strong cash flow, small reduction in our adjusted net debt, and our proposed final dividend is up 6.5% to 95.85, and that's in line with our interim dividend increase. So those are the highlights, and I'll now pass over to Patrick.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Always check your pockets when you've been with David. This is my first full year results presentation, and I think I've met or spoken to most of you, but just in case not, I joined the Go Ahead Group in March from Network Rail, and to say that my first 6 months have been interesting would be something of an understatement. However, despite some challenging operational and economic circumstances, I'm pleased to report that the group has delivered another set of robust financial results for the year ended on the 2nd of July, 2016. On an adjusted basis, profits are up in all three business areas. The impact of IAS 19 revised continues, in my view, to impede a good understanding of the results and of the business, and so we're reporting on an adjusted basis. I know that some of you have a preference for statutory numbers only, and so we've provided detailed reconciliations between the statutory and the adjusted numbers. We'll continue to review the presentation of our results during the coming year. I'm not going to dwell on this slide as I discuss each of the areas in a little bit more detail later on in the presentation. I've also changed a few of the slides from last year, and so would welcome feedback on what worked well and what you think could be improved. It's been another year of progress in regional bus, and with the exception of the Northeast, which continues to suffer from low levels of economic activity and low population growth, and Oxford, where the roadworks affecting our business are finally nearing completion, all of our bus operating companies have recorded improved performance. This is reflected in the margins for this business, which are now at sector-leading levels. Our strategy of driving revenue growth through contracts, optimizing mileage, and implementing modest targeted fare increases while bearing down on costs continues to deliver results. Lower fuel prices are also starting to come through. While in London, despite a further year-on-year reduction in quality incentive payments, margins have been maintained at 9.7%. Additional revenue from contract gains, extra mileage, and rail replacement work have allowed modest profit growth. Our contracts with Transport for London include an indexation clause, which when combined with reducing fuel costs, covers inflationary cost pressures. There was a return to quality incentive payments in quarter four with a payment of around 1.1 million, although in our view reduced road capacity and continued congestion mean that this will remain depressed in the current year. Turning to fuel, really all this chart does is show that we remain committed to a disciplined program of fuel hedging, fixing our fuel costs to provide the business with certainty. The profile has marginally changed from last year, but consistent with that reported at the half year. And now to rail. While profits and margins are higher than last year, this is more reflective of franchise changes and structural changes than any fundamental improvement to underlying trading or margins. Southeastern and London Midland continue to perform well against their directly awarded contracts, and they benefit in this year from lower depreciation. Profits at GTR and Southern, which we look at as a single management unit, are down. Bid costs are lower in the current financial year, although these will increase as we bid for more work in Germany and prepare our bid for the West Midlands franchise. The group continues to contribute significantly to the running costs of the railway through premium payments and profit share, and a total of some 220 million in the current year. Looking at the income statement as a whole, this table just summarises some of the key points and the key movements. The change to amortisation, which reduced following the end of the original Southeastern and London Midland franchises. The effective tax rate has come down a little bit as a result of a reduction in non-deductible items. And in line with the half year and our dividend policy, and as a result of sustainable increases to our bus profits, the final dividend that has been proposed brings the total dividend for the year to just under 96 pence, an increase of some 6.5%. Now, the dividend and capital allocation has been a topic for a little while, so I'm going to just touch on a few key points. So what's the board's policy on capital allocation? The increase in bus profitability over the last 5 years and the strengthening of our balance sheet means that the group now has more choices about how we allocate capital. The expansion into different geographies creates potential demands on capital. But we've operated using three key principles. We'll seek to manage our affairs in a way consistent with the retention of an investment grade rating. So we do have an investment grade rating. We may or may not actually retain it, depending on what we decide to do with the bond that refinances next year. But we'll manage our financial affairs in a way consistent with maintaining the investment grade rating. Ordinary dividends will be covered at 2x adjusted earnings over a 5-year cycle. And target gearing is going to be maintained at 1.5 to 2x EBITDA, with us aiming to be in normal, ordinary course in the lower half of that range. As part of the strategic planning process, the board has agreed the following priorities. Capital to sustain profits from existing businesses or meet commitments in franchises or other contracts. So that's our top priority, looking after what we've got. Capital reserved against known risks and contingencies. Capital to bid for opportunities in agreed target markets. Capital, including bonds and guarantees, to support new franchises and contracts. Capital to pay a progressive ordinary dividend. And then finally, returns to shareholders consistent with the capital principles. So that's what we're looking at. The potential for making further distribution to shareholders is absolutely there, and the board will leave that and have it under review. I've changed the presentation to this slide a little bit. One of the things I've done here is excluding the working capital movements that impact only on restricted cash, i.e. the cash that is trapped in franchises, largely generated by season tickets. Therefore, this provides a much clearer picture on the free cash flow that belongs to the group in that sense. Shows higher capex than last year as investments continue to be made in depots and bus fleets, particularly in London, to support new contracts. Free cash flow is about £5 million higher than last year, and as David said, this has flowed through to a small reduction in net debt. Looking at our balance sheet, our gearing remains marginally below the target level, although it has increased slightly in the current year, and next year there is more capital to be spent buying buses. I've talked a little bit about the capital allocation policy already. We are going to discuss that with investors. We've got the roadshows. We're going to take input from them, get their views and thoughts on what we're doing. In closing, a brief word on bus pensions. The key message in this slide is that the risk associated with the bus pension scheme is being actively managed. The deficit has come down from £48 million to around £2 million, driven by the liability-driven investment programme, which more closely links asset and liability performance. Now, I'm sure you have many questions, which I'll be very happy to answer, but before I do that, I'm going to hand you back to David.
Thank you, Patrick. So, we'll start off on regional bus as normal. Adjusted operating profit up 9.4%, margins improving up to 14.2%. That's the highest we've ever delivered, and it's sector leading. And when we started the £100 million profit target journey in 2012, margins were then at 10%, and this profit growth has been achieved sustainably. Steady passenger volumes with better second half than first, although there remains continued weakness in the northeast, which we talked about before. Revenue growth driven by higher contracting income, predominantly National Express contracts, park and ride contracts that we've won, and additional operated mileage as well, which is the organic growth, and fares increase in line with inflation. Highest customer satisfaction score in the UK remains with us, and that's at 89%. It shows that we're doing something right in terms of attracting people to our services. We continue to invest, we continue to innovate and seek improvements in our customer proposition. So we continue to invest in our fleet, over 300 vehicles, £72 million, keeping the average age consistent at 7.8 years. We've invested another £13 million in new depots, and this particular one is in New Haven, just outside of Brighton. So we're trying to grow organically. We're also looking at other mechanisms to make it easier for people to pay. So we've introduced PayPal onto our apps and onto our websites. And we've now got 200,000 people using our m-ticketing process. And we've got about 20% of people that use either the mobile tickets or the website actually going through PayPal. So all of these things are helping to make it easier for people to travel on our buses. Similarly, 85% of all of our real-time information is now on Google Transit Trip Planner. So you can go onto the Google City the Planner and actually then work out how to get from A to B, and it'll come up with our services in real-time information. And we now have that on our own apps as well. North East, for example, has gone live with that. We start contactless ticket trials during the course of the year at both Oxford and Newcastle. And we're experimenting and innovating with iBeacons in Southampton. So all of these things, innovating to attract people to stay ahead on the technology front. And on the services, which is our bread and butter and the core of what we do, we continue to look at ways that we can innovate. And the latest one, and one of the better ones, is we're actually doing interurban coach services now between Oxford and Birmingham. We have the resources, we've got the experience of doing it, so we've set up a new service to go to Birmingham. And along the same line, because it's not just about growth, it's also about looking at your cost base, and we've introduced lean engineering practices in a more professional way than we've done before, and we're just embarking on that across all of our bus businesses. And finally, just to say that the BSOG is protected, according to the government, until 2020-21. Now, every year I'm sure, talked about something to do with what's going on in terms of the regulation debate. And now, this year, we talk about the Bus Services Bill. So the bill will not impose any particular arrangements on local authorities or on bus operators. And the new powers that will come out of the bill will be for the local authorities and local areas to decide how they implement them, if at all. There need to be clear arrangements that will be needed for ensuring the powers are used accountably and that they're in the best interests of both customers and taxpayers. And in our opinion, any structural reform that is changing that needs to be economically sustainable, and that needs to embrace private sector innovation. We're currently working, we've been working for a whole year on in terms of working with the DfT with this bill, and we're now working on the secondary legislation that underpins it, because the bill is an enabling bill. We've always believed it's about partnerships. So partnership working is how we conduct our business. Our devolved management structures, however, really put us in a good position for working with other devolved structures and creating that local accountability in political, local political life. There are opportunities out of this. We only operate about 7% of the regional bus network, so in the end, we can look and see what opportunities that may arise as a consequence of franchising, if that happens. And if it does happen, at the moment, we wouldn't anticipate it happening before 2019. That's a planning estimate. Who knows? Finally, I will say, the building itself doesn't actually increase bus use. It has to be aligned with local authority powers to actually reduce congestion, and reduce congestion in order to improve punctuality and reliability. Plus, it has to be aligned with measures to actually increase and improve the vitality of the high streets and the town centres. Those are the things that actually drive bus usage, not changing the regulations. They don't change. They won't drive bus usage at all. So all the other measures that could be enshrined within that bill, we can do anyway. If you want smart ticketing, we do smart ticketing. If you want cashless, we do cashless. And all of these things can be achieved by working in partnership, which is what we do in places like Brighton, Knoxville and Plymouth. So ultimately, in my opinion, any local authority that does go down the road of franchising will be doing it entirely for political reasons. Turning to London Bus. We do remain the largest London bus operator. That's a pretty good achievement for over a number of years now. And we hold 24 to 25% of the market, retaining our market share, and we retained it with consistent margins. We remain a high quality, cost efficient operator, and those are the key factors that enable us to retain these good margins. I've talked in the past quite a lot about roadworks. Roadworks and congestion in London are finally stabilising. And in the last quarter, we received 1.1 million of QICS payments, quality incentive contract bonus payments, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. However, this is currently a benign period. There's less traffic. It's a summer period, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to see what's actually going to happen, what resilience there will be in the road network when we get into the more heavy traffic areas and times of the year, and such as the winter and coming up to Christmas. Passenger numbers have declined in London buses. That doesn't affect us in the short term. What happens in the long term is another matter. And they've declined quite considerably because of slow moving buses in central London. People are not going to carry on accepting that. We've carried on investing ourselves. So a £7 million investment in a strategically located bus depot in Barking. And plus we've expanded another existing depot. So we continue to bring private capital into the London bus scene. We're also starting very shortly, we'll be launching the largest electric bus fleet in the UK, and the largest one definitely and obviously in London as well, with 53 buses, electric buses on the 507-521s out of Waterloo. And we're very pleased to be doing that, and we're obviously doing that in liaison with Transport for London. Overall, I mean, steady margins, we're still the largest, there's still lots of opportunity. London remains a unique place to be operating buses, vibrant economy, growing population. Population growth is heading towards the 9 million. That population growth, generally speaking, is in the suburbs. Two-thirds of all bus usage is in the suburbs, we're ideally placed to actually deal with that. TfL, in their original planning document, are talking about another 500 buses over their planning cycle to increase annual bus trips to 2.6 billion. However, There are some headwinds for TfL. The headwind is actually freezing bus fares as a consequence of mayoral priorities. And also they've got a gradual reduction in central London government grant of about 700 million over the next few years. So there are some headwinds for TfL that we will need to deal with them. Turn to rail. Overall a good result in the year, despite GTR not contributing to profits. And that's not contributing as a consequence of the operational challenges that we've had and the difficulties we've had. Margin now for rail is at 2.3%. We're very pleased that we got the direct award contract to London Midland, and that will be in place until October 2017. As I said in the highlights, our contributions to the government are over £222 million. And overall, as a whole industry, the industry in terms of tax generated by the sector is about 3.9 billion, which is not just a little bit shy of what the government actually puts in every year into the rail industry in terms of operating cost and improvement cost. Our core focus remains on delivering the commitments from our existing franchises, in particular GTR, and we're working with, as you'd expect, with Network Rail and DfT to minimise disruption as a consequence of the London Bridge programme and the London Bridge rebuild. the Thames Link programme and the London Bridge rebuild. And this last weekend, we actually saw another milestone achieved where the concourse was opened up at London Bridge. It's not all finished yet, but people can start actually seeing what it's all been about and what they've been waiting for. So that's good news. And we've been shortlisted for the new West Midlands franchise, otherwise known as the London Midland contract at the moment. UK rail market continues to offer opportunities. As I said, we're bidding for the West Midlands franchise. Individually, looking at the individual contracts, so South Eastern is now under a directly awarded contract and it's delivered some very good and strong trading performances, contributed nearly £40 million to the DfT through a profit share mechanism which is enshrined within the contract. And we're very clear that we will only improve performance by working very closely with Network Rail. So we have joint performance plans in place. We go to extensive lengths in South Eastern to allow access to the network for Network Rail engineers to actually mend and improve, and that means changing some of our timetables to facilitate that. We facilitated and helped get the Dover-Folkestone railway back up and running. I'm sure many of you didn't even know it wasn't, but it's back up and running 3 months early, and that's a good example of working together. And again, the important milestone has been reached at London Bridge Station. And the next milestone for us will be in December 2016, when the fourth track into London Bridge opens, and that will give us more flexibility and to reduce delays and more reliability on the network. So that's it. None of that happens from the concourse opening. What happens is when we get the tracks back and we can get more reliability into the network. And turning to London Midland, we had a direct award extension for London Midland until October 2017. That performance continues to improve, which we're very pleased about. We want to shout about as well, because that's leading to steady increase in both passenger journeys and passenger revenue, and also consequently to customer satisfaction scores. So we're at a leading edge in terms of 86%, and we've got some of the best punctuality scores in the sector. Turning to GTR, the £6.5 billion Thames Link programme, it is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to respond to what we've had is with phenomenal passenger growth over just the last 5 years on the southern network of about 40%. But remember that Thames Link actually was Thames Link 2000 when it started. This is a very late engineering project to deliver increased performance for a very large and expanding railway. And we need to do all this to actually redress underinvestment in the railways for a long period of time. And I have to say very firmly, we welcome the DfT's new project board that's been talked about in the papers today. We're looking forward to Chris Gibb coming and working on that project board. We're looking forward to working with him and working collaboratively with the DfT and Network Rail and other industry partners to do anything we can to improve the resilience on the southern network. This franchise has been established as a different style of contract, but it's all there to actually implement the modernisation plans and transform services for customers. That's what it's about. So some of our commitments are about introducing new rolling stock, so it's up to 1,400 new train carriages, and to improve the timetables and to modernise working practices. At the centre of the Thames Link programme is the rebuild of London Bridge, and it would be true to say that's had a more significant impact on the reliability of the network than the planners ever anticipated. We lose more. In the beginning, we lost more minutes delayed and cancellations in 1 week than was originally planned over the whole life of this project. That's the scale of the differences in terms of its effect on our network. We've had independent reports into what's been going on in terms of the capacity constraints as a consequence of the London Bridge redevelopment. That took place during the course of the year. Our performance benchmarks were revised as a consequence of that. Basically, the network has been unable to support the levels of performance that we've been contractually undertaken in the franchise. That reduced capacity, lack of resilience in the network, the strike action, which has been well recorded and commented on, and the increased levels of absence that are created as part of that, have all caused disruption for southern customers. We have been apologising for that, we continue to apologise for that, but all our efforts are about how do we improve the situation. So we're focused on resolving the trade union dispute and we're focused on how to resolve that through the modernisation programme. Along the way, of course, we've got about 200 committed obligations, not just the ones to do with the modernisation of working practices. And some of those have been about procurement of the rolling stock, which we've achieved, introducing Wi-Fi at 100-odd stations. There's a continual programme of work that we're doing behind the scenes and according to the franchise. And on the rolling stock, for instance, sort of under the radar, we now have 108 of our train carriages all in situ on the Gatwick Express, and they're all running up and down. So we expect GTR to begin contributing to Rail Division profits once the Thames Link programme is complete, and that's in 2018, and our estimate of a 1.5% margin over the life of the franchise remains unchanged. Going to overseas contract wins, we were awarded a five-year contract to operate bus services in Singapore, in Loyang, and that starts this Sunday, and we're confident and ready and very pleased to be there. It operates very similar features to the London bus market, and with the revenue risk being taken by the government. We expect the revenues to be 500 million Singapore Sing dollars. It's 25 bus routes, 400 buses. And we're now in the process of submitting for the third tranche that's come out of the Singaporean change to the contracting bus network in a place called Seletar. And that is being bid for this October. We've also been awarded two contracts to operate rail services in Germany in the state of Baden-Württemberg. And that they are from June 2019 to 2032. And their revenues are 1.6 billion euros. Their gross cost contracts, incentive regimes linked to revenue growth and operational performance, all things that are within our normal expertise. So finally, going on to summary and outlook, the new financial year has begun with some similar trends to the second half of 2015-16. In bus, we have a resilient business model, equipped for economic uncertainty, if that's what we're heading for with Brexit, for instance. Operating high-quality services in good bus markets. We continue to innovate to improve our customer proposition and to help drive revenues, while future fuel cost reductions will help manage the cost base. In rail, we expect continued strong performance in South East and in London Midland, and the GTR network will benefit from new trains and more drivers, and it'll enable us to make improvements to the customer experience. Singapore bus operations, as I said, are set to launch this weekend. We continue to explore other opportunities both in Singapore and Germany. We're pretty pleased that there's a pipeline of work in both those places, and in other similar international markets we'll continue to be looking at. The group remains in a strong financial position, good cash generation, robust balance sheet, supporting our dividend policy, allowing the flexibility to pursue value-adding opportunities while keeping capital allocation under review, as explained by Patrick. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll now take some questions. I'll end on that one. Right, okay, off we go.
I've got the mic. Damien Barr, RBC. Could I ask questions about two areas? First of all, on UK bus, what's your thinking of fares policy for this year, i.e. the year to June 17? And beyond, do you plan to sort of pass on the benefit of the fuel cost reduction, or would you still see inflation like fare increases? Also within UK bus, can you just talk a little bit about the differences within regional bus in terms of demand, just to get a feeling for how much is sort of roadworks affected Oxford and what the underlying performance of non-roadwork impacted business has been like? And then very finally on capital allocation, you talked about a five-year cycle. Could you explain a five-year cycle of what that you're looking at? Is that rail contracts? Is that London bus contracts? Which cycle? And within that, when you also mentioned about capital for sort of rail bids, how do you assess how much sort of contingent equity funding requirement you need to put aside? You know, i.e., what's your assumption on the kind of rail bidding you'll do when you're thinking about that?
Okay. I will get Patrick to answer the last question. Well, I'd like to thank you profusely for starting off with the bus question. In terms of fares, what we try to do is because we deal with devolved management structures, we allow them to work through how best to increase their fares in the right places. So we never have this blanket approach of all fares go up by one certain percentage point at a certain point in time. They will do it and fine-tune it according to what's happening in the local market. if they're under stress or they're trying to find ways of actually growing revenue in a different way, if they were looking at different ways of growing revenue, i.e. by keeping fares down, then we would support them. It's a complex picture is what I'm saying. So what we did last year, the fares either increased on average the same as inflation or slightly under. Actually being able to do under is a combination of the strength of the business, and some of that strength of the business will come through fuel reductions in prices. So it's not a straight answer to your question. There's an element of it being passed on, but it's in a whole mix and it's a whole matrix. We're very, very conscious in terms of our bus market that price is one of the differentials, and that price is also something that can deter people from travelling. So we only put prices up as a last resort. If we could get away with never putting prices up, we would. But of course, obviously, we've got our own cost inflations to pressures to deal with. So it's a mixture of those things. But the fuel gives us an opportunity to pass some of it back to the passenger, which is what we are doing. But it's not a straight kind of relationship. In terms of regional bus patronage, there is no doubt, and because we've measured it, that we talked quite a lot about Oxford Roadworks. The Oxford Roadworks took place. We then marketed the services when the Oxford Roadworks finished. To be credit to the local authority, unlike in some places, these roadworks have actually improved the road network and actually improved the flow of traffic. Improving the flow of traffic and improving the flow of buses means they become more reliable, which means we can attract more people. So actually, some of the pain has been worthwhile. And we then marketed the services, in particular as Abingdon services, and the passengers came back. So we've not seen any shortfall and actually been fine. So that's pretty good. In the end, over across the UK, there is a regional divide between north and south. So we still have difficulties in terms of revenue growth in the northeast. That is driven not by actual numbers, it's about the number of journeys. So the passengers are the same numbers. It's about their what extra journeys they may be making on the margin. They're far more circumspect about that, and that must be, we assume, a consequence of the economy in the northeast rather than anything else. So, you know, the additional bus journey in on a Saturday may not be taking place, but they'll still be doing the Monday to Friday journeys. It's that sort of pattern that we're experiencing. But there is certainly a very much a difference between the northeast and other parts of the UK that we operate buses in. And I'll pass over to.
Okay, I think you've passed two questions to me. There was a five-year cycle question and a capital reserved for bidding question. The five-year cycle is not a series of static blocks. It's to use a rail analogy. It's more like a moving block than a fixed block. So we're saying, if you look over any given five-year period, on average, we should stick within that principle. We're not saying it's measured from 2010 to 2015. And really what we're trying to do is provide a little bit of flexibility for years where profits may go down a little bit because we're at the end of a rail franchise or something like that, where there is the flexibility to maintain the growing dividend. The important thing is to remember that part of the reason behind the Bus 100 target was so that we could get ourselves comfortable that we could pay we could support the payment of the base dividend from bus profits. In terms of reserving capital for bidding for franchises and contracts, clearly the difficulty with that is it depends, and it depends on the type of franchise you're bidding for. So in Singapore, for example, the capital requirements are pretty small. The buses are provided by the local authority. The depot is provided by the transport authority, and therefore there's a small performance bond that essentially guarantees our the performance of our obligations. In Germany, there are a wide range of different types of contracts. The two that we bid for at the moment, largely. The local transport authority buys the trains and leases them back to us, so there isn't a guarantee there. But there will be different forms of contracts. Some we will need to take more risk in the delivery of the capital assets. We'll need to buy some train maintenance depots. And then you come to UK Rail, which is where clearly the most significant numbers are. We've not really thought about saying as a board we will reserve 100 million, 150 million, 200 million, a number against potential franchises, because we want to have the opportunity to bid for franchise contracts where we believe we can deliver a good service and make money. And that's what I think drives the slightly cautious approach that we take, because it allows us that flexibility and the robustness of our balance sheet, which, as many of you point out, is the most robust in the sector, gives us options to bid for contracts that we think we can make money at.
Okay, thank you very much. Next questions?
Hi, it's Annalise Vermeulen from Morgan Stanley. I just have three questions, please. Firstly, on London, the comment you made in the statement about things starting to improve in London in terms of roadworks and congestion and potentially improving those Quicks payments. Can you elaborate on, is that roadworks starting to finish to sort of come to an end, or are TfL actively trying to manage congestion? There still seem to be a lot of taxis and vans and so on the road. I don't know if anything's being done to try and to curb that. And then secondly, you talked about bid costs going up for next year. If you can put a rough number on that, and similarly, how much of that do you think will be UK and non-UK? And then lastly, on the other international markets you're exploring other than Germany and Singapore, are there any that you can share with us that you're looking at? And on a related note, do you have an idea or a target in mind of how much non-UK or international business you'd like the group to have, as you know, in terms of percentage? Thank you.
Okay. Patrick will come in with bid costs at the end, and I'll start off with the Quicks payments ones. What's happened over the last 18 months has been a combination of the normal sort of public realm improvements that take place in London, where there's been a lot of conversions of one-way streets, or one-way streets into two-way streets, and public realm issues taking place, which will reduce road capacity, combined with cycle superhighways, combined with the normal plethora of gas works, water main works, and all the rest of it that go with it. The new mayor, so that reached a crescendo because the old mayor wanted all of this work done so that nobody could undo it if they didn't want to do it in the future. So that reached a crescendo at the point of his departure. The new mayor is, quite rightly in my mind, taking a review of some of these projects and looking to see what happens. So some of that work has settled down. Generally speaking, it's much more benign in the summer. Some of the works don't take place, etc., etc. So we are never going to get rid of roadworks like water, gas, etc., and other mains. That's all going to carry on, nor the public realm. So then you're back to cycle superhighways. And what's happened with that is what happens. I talked about Oxford's roadworks. That caused mayhem. It caused a load of problems. We lost a lot of passenger traffic. Caused a lot of delays, grief, etc. But once it was over, it was actually better. The difference in cycle superhighways is that the work is now finished. Great, tick, that's better. But it's actually a permanent removal of road space from one form of the user of the roads to another form, another user of the roads. And I make no judgment as to whether that's right or wrong, but what it inevitably will create is a lack of resilience in the network. It's just as I described earlier for the rail network. If you take out capacity, you've got less resilience. If you take out capacity on the road network, you've got less resilience. So although it's better at the moment, from my experience, when you come into the winter periods, it's a whole new ball game in terms of what we've got to face. Now, I may be wrong, but we'll wait and see. So what are TfL doing about it? Yes, they are getting far more sophisticated in managing the congestion. What they do is a lot more gating. They learn a lot of that through the Olympics. So they take out traffic from the central London, but the traffic's still there. It just gets moved into the inner ring roads around London. Eventually, in my opinion, you have to take out different forms of traffic, which you've set up. you set up the question, which is you need to think about any private traffic in central London. You need to think about how you do the deliveries. You need to think about how you deal with the Amazon delivery units going around all over the place across central London, et cetera, et cetera. So eventually there needs to be restraint in actually to enable traffic to flow freely or effectively across London in order to allow businesses to work. But they haven't got to that point yet. So there's more to come, and there's more for us to watch, and I don't anticipate Quicks coming back in the way it used to be 5 years ago. In terms of where we're looking internationally, we're really pleased with what we've done. We're really pleased with Singapore. I think I said a year ago it was slightly more opportunistic because they came to us and, hey-ho, we do run the majority of buses in London, and they're actually running contracts very similar to London. But now we've got out there, of course, there is a pipeline of work. So they have now got to a position where all of the network will go to a contracting situation, and they're trying to grow the network by another 1,000 buses. So we feel that we're very well positioned to actually take advantage of some of that. And there's also a lot of work taking place in terms of some of the high-speed trains going into Malaysia, and we're looking at how we can set up a base there and actually be in a good position for other work that's coming up in the pipeline. Similarly, in Germany, it's a market 30% bigger than the UK. There's a lot of work coming out which don't require large amounts of bid costs to go to them. The revenue is generally controlled by the local authority, and you're providing the service and you're procuring the rolling stock as appropriate. So there's a big pipeline of work for that, and we're looking forward to actually expanding in Germany. And then what we're doing outside of that is looking to see what other similar regimes that we would go and look at. So we aren't going to go to places which take big risks. We're quite conservative in what we do. We're very conservative about where we go. So we're looking at places which have good, strong rule of law, have a good, transparent procurement process, and we won't be taking risks from that point of view. And we are actively looking and actively pre-qualifying for bids in other countries at this moment in time, and that's going on. In terms of what's the amount we're looking for, we're looking very clearly, and in Germany, we're looking to get organic growth. We deliberately went in as ourselves without any partners, and we're looking to grow that organically, so that to start off with where we want to be is the profits will feed further bidding. And so we don't expect to get any of the profits back into the UK for a little while, but we expect them to feed further bids, and as we get to a critical mass, only then will we start looking to see if we take the profits back inside. So we have a plan as to what we're doing, but it's still early days.
In terms of the cost of supporting those activities, Singapore, we're busily preparing a bid for the third package, and that'll cost, I think, somewhere between half and a million. We will spend between £1.5 and £2 million bidding in Germany, and then we've got the West Midland franchise, which we expect to be the normal price of a UK bid, which is somewhere around £5 million.
Okay, thank you. Joe.
Morning, Joe Spooner from Jefferies. You made some comments in your presentation that the concourse is now open at London Bridge. I think the fourth track, you said, was coming online later in the year. Are you at a point yet where the disruption or the risk of all those disruptions, you're starting to see light at the end of the tunnel around all of that infrastructure work? Secondly, I think there's a bond due in September of 17, the £200 million bond. Is that a material opportunity in terms of rebasing the cost of that, given the where interest rates are nowadays? And then finally, back on the Quicks, presumably if there's less opportunity to naturally capture those revenues, is the stance to try and price that those lost opportunities into the core contract? Thank you.
Patrick will answer the 200.
So I do that first.
Go on in.
Make a change. As you correctly pointed out, we've got a £200 million bond which refinances in September 2017. in preparation for that, we have entered into a bridge financing facility with our relationship banks, some of whom are in the room, and so thank you for your support. That bridge facility gives us certainty that we can pay back the bond. So we essentially draw down a £200 million facility and pay back the bond. That gives us the flexibility to go to the market when we think the time is right. And so there are two or three risks that we think about when we look at the requirement to refinance that bond. The first is execution risk, which we've largely reduced by entering into the bridge facility. The second will then be around pitching whatever new instrument we go into so that it gives us the right mix of capital funding in terms of term and form and flexibility. And so we've got plenty of time, and the bridge takes out that critical pressure where you suddenly have to be in the market at a particular point in time. And then the third is interest rate risk, which is the point you mentioned. And so one of the things that we will have a look at is there a way of locking into current interest rates to allow us to take advantage of the currently very low interest rates. That's something we'll keep under review. There are a number of different ways that we could do it. One of our peers chose to do it by redeeming the bond 18 months early. We don't think that in our circumstance that would be right and would offer value for money, but we will explore a variety of options, and once we've got something sensible, then we will let you know.
Okay, thank you. To use your metaphor of the tunnel, we're not at the beginning. We can see the light, but we're not quite there yet. We always knew that 2016 was going to be a difficult year, because 2016 was the introduction of a lot of the rolling stock and still doing it without some of the infrastructure improvements. Progressively, as we head towards 2018 and the end of the project, progressively it will get better. It will get better because more rolling stock comes in. It will get better because there's more tracks to use. It will get better because there's more stability in the system. It doesn't take away the underlying fact that this infrastructure still is requires a lot of investment, and on a normal day, you're still in a position where two-thirds of the delays to passengers are a consequence of the infrastructure, not of anything else. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. We are getting there. We are getting there on an incremental basis. The light will be fully exposed by 2018. But we're very confident that we will get there. In terms of quicks, you've described absolutely perfectly what should be happening, which is that as the quicks monies go down, the contract prices go up to recompense for that. But actually the bit that doesn't fit so neatly into that economic model is competition, and therefore you bid competitively for these contracts and you bid according to what the market will bear. In economic theory, absolutely right. If one source of income is going down for reasons beyond our control, then we will factor that back into the contract prices. But it's a very, very competitive market in London. Next.
Okay. Hello, it's Joe Thomas from HSBC. On the balance sheet, Patrick, you outlined sort of four or five criteria that you were judging it through, which all sounded very sensible, but I'm not sure how that's moved on, how the thinking has moved on, because I think it's what we understood already. So perhaps you could just sort of elucidate on what you said now and how that compares to what might have been said before, in terms of the opportunity for releasing cash. Secondly, it might be mad to be raising this now at a time of widespread strike action, but you were obviously culpable for some of the driver shortages on the GTR franchise. Do you think you've got those issues sorted out now, the things that you're responsible for sorted out, and is there any risk on that? And then finally, could you just talk about your appetite for more UK rail, especially in light of increased capital intensity?
How does what we've said today move us on? I think we've tried to be a lot clearer and a lot more specific. I don't think the sense of what we're saying, which I think is the point you're making, has fundamentally changed. The board considered the possibility for distributing further capital to shareholders. Clearly, there is the potential and the strength within the balance sheet to allow that to happen, but concluded that with the uncertainties around GTR that remain, we didn't think this was the right moment, but it's absolutely under continuous review. David.
Okay, in terms of driver shortages, I don't want to go over historical reasons, where we ended up on the first day, et cetera, or how the original planning assumptions were made on a level of activity and level of diagrams that were meant to operate that weren't in the original ITT. I don't want to go down that road again. What we have done is introduce and initiate a driving school program that's the largest in Europe, if not the whole world, but I can't say that with facts. We've actually, since January 15, 243 drivers have come out of that school, and we have currently got 267 in the school. Now, like me, you're not experts in driver training, but trust me, those are big numbers to have got through the whole process and to be in training. The real problem we face, and this goes back to structural issues as much as anything in terms of the whole industry, it takes us 12 to 14 months to get that person out of it. It takes longer to train a train driver than a commercial airline pilot. And so the problem is there's always a lag effect. So you'd think, problem solved. We've got 243 come out. But as 243 come out, because of the age profile of our workforce, we've got another load of people that are retiring and leaving. And then the other issue that we have is that we're introducing the 700 series Siemens trains and other trains as well, but particularly the 700 series, which require driver training. So we need to train people to drive these trains. One of the issues we have is those trains are actually late at the moment. So we've trained a lot of people once, which means taking them off the tracks to train them. That's perfectly right, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. And then we have to train them again because the learning school period has expired, and we have to do that process all again. So what I'm painting is a picture that it's not a perfect world, that we've just got people coming out that we immediately will solve the problem. In a bus world, you can throw masses of resources to it if you've got a problem, and at the other end, after 6 weeks, there will be a load of drivers that will solve the problem. And it just doesn't work the same way in trains. It's such a long lead time, and it takes so long to get people trained on every diagram. And if I gave you more reasons of the complicated nature, you would despair. But it just takes a long time. And we're doing everything we possibly can to actually train the numbers of staff we need. Eventually, it will all come good, because once everyone's trained on all the train sets and learns all the routes, then it becomes fine. But it is fairly precarious still going forward. In terms of the driver shortages balance sheet, we're looking for more UK rail. It hasn't changed our appetite. We're bidding for the West Midlands franchise. I think there are some areas where we might be more circumspect. If the West Midlands franchise is the London Midland franchise that we currently operate, and we therefore take trains into Euston, if part of that ITT is about the overhaul of Euston, we may be quite sceptical about the planning assumptions on the amount of delays that come out of that, he says with one of life's understatements. But we will, we've learnt once, we ain't going to go there. So it will change some of our planning ourselves and how we bid for some of this work, because we wouldn't go into that all over again. But it's still a healthy rail market, and we still intend to bid, and we still think we've got the skill sets to do it. And by Jove, have we learnt on GTR. Any more questions?
Morning, Alex Patterson from Investec. Two questions, please. Firstly, on regional bus volumes, if there's been a recovery in passengers at Oxford, should we look to some modest growth in the next 12 months, or are there other areas which are perhaps under pressure? And then just on rail, congratulations on bringing on 119 services back for Southern next week. Just on the industrial relations, is there, you know, are the RMT at the table in discussions at the moment? Is there any sign that a resolution can be mixed? Is there something that you can point to which might be a catalyst to help that? Or is it just an area of great uncertainty and it will be resolved when it's resolved?
Okay, thank you. I'll start with the last one. Yes, we are. Some of the improvements will start on Monday when we bring back 119 of the train services, and then progressively we'll bring back the other train services. We took them off to provide certainty for people in their travel over the summer and when less people were travelling anyway. People are now back to work. We want to get those services back as soon as we possibly can. We haven't just got one issue going on with trade unions. We have several issues going on with trade unions. And at one level, ticket office staff, for instance, yes, we are in discussions with the RMT on ticket office staff, and we are in discussions with the TSSA on ticket office staff. And as a consequence of those discussions, they've called off the proposed strike for next Wednesday, which is the 7th. So there have been productive negotiations, productive outcomes. The strike has been suspended and we will move on, and we're having discussions with everybody. It's a little bit more difficult with the conductors. We are always willing and ready and able to talk. We've been to ACAS many, many times. They are planning a dispute next week. We would urge them to move on. Actually, we've really got to get... Now, people don't like it. The staff don't like it. They just want to come to work and do a decent job. They don't actually want all this grief themselves. And we need to respect where they are on all of this. We've got commitments to modernise the train service. We've got new train stock coming in, which isn't there. It isn't built for guards. It's built around the driver and the safety being in the control of the driver. It's the natural progression. It's a natural movement of modernisation. It's a natural thing that we're doing. And I doubt if you'd find any other industry that would be so benignly treating their employees at a point of change. Jobs guaranteed, conditions guaranteed, conditions and jobs guaranteed beyond the life of the franchise, etc., etc. We've got conditions around how we would treat people that we've enshrined and would enshrine. We've agreed everything you can possibly agree, apart from the fact that we don't want the conductor in charge of safety of the train. It would be less safe, in our opinion. We've spent millions and millions of pounds on the rolling stock. We are just the first in the queue. If you buy any new trains, they're going to come without being built for guards. There's an inevitable progress that we're going through, and we want people to work with us. So what we want is the RMT to work with us and be part of the solution and not be part of the problem and get back to providing a good service to customers. That's what we want. Bus volumes, modest growth. There's so many moving parts. That's the problem. At the moment, we're really saying that if we're keeping our head above water and keeping to what we've been doing over the last year is quite a good outcome. That's not because we think there's any structural problems going on in any areas that we operate, apart from, say, the northeast. It's just the unpredictability of what may be happening with the economy, what may be happening with jobs, etc. And obviously, we're a derived demand. People only use us to do something else, go to work, carry on going to school, I assume, and go to the shops and spend money and all the rest of it. So steady passenger volumes going forward. Okay.
Gerald Koo from Liberum. Going back to GTR, can you just clarify where you are with regard to the emergency timetable? So you had the original emergency timetable agreed with DfT, and that, as I recall, runs till the end of summer. I'm not quite sure when that is. Where are you in terms of, you've talked about the extra services that are being restored. Is that the end of the emergency timetable, or is that a new arrangement? And how long, if so, how long does that run for? And also, can you just, on the sick out and absence issues on the guards, are we still experiencing problems there, or is it just official industrial action that's the problem at the moment?
Okay, thank you. The
by definition, so for instance, what we reintroduce on Monday is the West London line, most of the West London line, all of the West London line, and reinstate all of the metro services. So by definition, the emergency timetable therefore ends on those services. We will then start looking at things like Redhill services, Reigate services, the Seaford services. So on a progressive basis, they will all start coming back in, and as they come back in, by definition, that emergency timetable disappears on those lines. And then we've got a plan to try to get that through by the end of October. And yes, it was agreed with the DfT in terms of what we're doing, and yes, they are very keen that we reinstate the timetable. In terms of absence six, you know, bizarrely, it's easier to manage a dispute in many respects because you know what's going on. The problem is managing unknown absenteeism and sickness, etc. And we have to manage through processes. This is, you know, we're a very structured business with loads of terms and conditions and things that we do and processes we do for long-term sickness and absence, and we follow those processes, and that's what we're doing at the moment. We just follow a process in dealing with people who are not attending work on a regular basis. Any other questions? Well, you're allowed to? I'm not sure. Come on, okay.
Damien Burrough, RPC. Can I just one more general question? And that's about your contracted businesses, both in rail and London Bus. Could you just give it some feel of where there's indexation to inflation, how quickly the indexation is re-indexed in each? For example, if we're into an environment with accelerating inflation, do you have a lag on catching that up? And what kind of impact would that have on the business? Or is it pretty much matching what's happening in the real world?
It's a good question, and the answer is that it's slightly different in each of the contracts, and is driven. One of the benefits of having contracts that start at different dates is the indexation impact is spread through the year, so you've got a natural averaging effect that matches the indexation across the whole business. On any individual contract, it will clearly be different. But if you look at Singapore and London Bus, there is a monthly update to portions of the index. So some of it comes through immediately, some of it is a lag catch up. If your hypothesis, which may or may not be true, I'm sure it's true. It's your hypothesis. It may or may not be right that we could be in a world of increasing inflation. Then there is going to be a small lag, but at this point, I don't think it's going to be material.
The bigger issue, if you come to London Bus contracts, is the fact that the index that you use for wage cost is always going to be out of kilter with the reality of what happens in London, because you're taking an average across the whole of the UK, and there's a big difference between what's happening to wage costs in the North East as opposed to what happens to wage costs in London, where it's a more vibrant economy and you are trying much harder to attract labour. That has happened, that's been going on that way for the last 20-odd years since it first came in, and no one yet, including myself, has ever come up with a better measure of it, because I did want to measure that. I wanted a measure that measured bus drivers' pay in London, but that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? So that wasn't allowed. So that's the bigger issue that we have, is always the lag of, is the difference between an average UK wage inflation price and a London wage inflation price. Yep, okay. Excellent. Thank you very much once again. Thank you all for your questions, and thank you for coming a week early. Remember, we're not here next week. Thank you very much.